Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we look at the science fiction field from all angles, past, present, and future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And today is the 24th of July, 2023, and we're going to be exploring fuzzies, alien creatures devised by H. Beam Piper and updated by John Scalzi. We'll also have our usual roundup of recommendations of past, present, and future science fiction. Well, last time we talked about The Empire Strikes Back, and we had some responses from our listeners, so thanks to those who contacted us. Emmanuel said, "Excellent episode." He says, "It's really interesting to learn more about how a script and a movie are made. They are living things, and it's remarkable how crucial elements can sometimes be added at the last moment." And he also said that he would have laughed out loud at Colin's dad joke, if only there was air to breathe. It was the one about there being no atmosphere on the moon, I think. So. Joey wrote, "Great episode. I agree with Colin that some of those themes should make it into Star Wars Visions series." And then he says, "There's a podcast called Best Movies Never Made that did a multicast reading of Lee Brackett's script that's definitely worth checking out." And Colin, I think you did check it out because you said you found it was a two-part episode from December 2019.
That's right.
And Andy wrote, "I enjoyed that." This is what we like to hear, folks. "I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but only stuff that's inside the films. I've never been into all the peripheral stuff like directors, writers, actors. So this episode was interesting, but as always, you two carried a subject that wasn't to my interests and still made it great fun." So thank you, Andy.
That's a nice compliment.
That's what we do best, I think. Yeah. We take the stuff that you're not interested in and we make it slightly listenable. So, and it's that, by the way, it's that kind of attitude, that kind of response that has led us to be named by Feedspot.com as now being the fifth best UK sci-fi podcast. Isn't that amazing? We used to be at number six, we're now at number five, so we're slowly climbing the league table there.
And maybe someday we can make it to the Locus or the Hugos or other awards. Who knows?
Yes. Today, Feedspot.com, which nobody has ever heard of. Sorry, Feedspot. tomorrow, big awards. Now, if you want to join in the conversation, you can post comments on our blog at 101sf.blogspot.com, or you can find us on Facebook as Science Fiction 101 Podcast. Colin, could you introduce us, please, to our main topic for today, which is fuzzies?
Yes. You know, longtime listeners of the podcast will know that I'm a fan of John Scalzi and his works. Mm-hmm. I read his books. I read his articles. I follow him on Twitter. That's starting to sound kind of scary, but I trust you. It's just interest. I enjoy what he writes a lot. And about 15 years ago, he wrote a book called Fuzzy Nation. Mm-hmm. And he said it was a reimagining of a work by one of his favorite authors, H. Beam Piper.
Yeah.
And so for this podcast, I suggested to Phil that we would read the original Little Fuzzy from 1962 and then read John Scalzi's reimagining, updating, rebooting of it from 2005 and, you know, compare and contrast.
It's a bit like watching a film that is a remake of an earlier film. And I have to say, reading these two books in rapid succession, I find it very difficult to remember what happened in the one book and what happened in the other. You get confused in your memory as to what happened in the one and didn't happen in the other. Is that the same for you?
Well, no. The other podcast that I'm on, Take Me to Your Reader, we do adapted works. And I've done this kind of an exercise 110 times, I think.
Yeah.
And so I've gotten very used to, you know, trying to keep, okay, this was here and this was there. And I do take, I wouldn't say extremely detailed notes, but little highlights to try and draw my mind back into one versus the other.
Right, yeah. When I was doing my PhD, I used to, I had to compare lots of different script versions of a thing and then compare it to the film that was made from the script. And so I had to do that as well, keep really quite detailed notes, because when you start reading the first script, you never know which bits of that script are going to carry forward to the second draft, the third draft, and then into the film. So yeah, I used to do that, but it, to me, that's like work. So for a podcast, I don't feel like doing that. But what I did do, as I was reading Little Fuzzy, I highlighted bits of text on my Kindle where something seemed either good or important or was worthy of discussion. And I intended to then do that with the Scalzi book, but in fact, I just found that it was so similar to the first book that I hardly made any notes at all. Anyway, we can talk about how they compare later on. But should we first of all talk about Little Fuzzy in isolation?
Yes, let's talk about the past.
Yeah, and then we can move on to the present and possibly the future. I think I'd read Little Fuzzy before, or at least part of it. I'm pretty sure when I was a child, something like 7, 8, or 9 years old, I'm pretty sure I had some kind of book that had Little Fuzzy in it. I don't think it would have been the entire novel. That seems very unlikely to me. But it's possible that it was some kind of anthology that had just a selection from Little Fuzzy. And the scene that, as I was reading the Little Fuzzy now as an adult, the scene where really we first get to know Little Fuzzy and we see him interacting with a human, that scene was very, very familiar to me. So I'm certain I read it as a child.
You know, it was nominated for a Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1963, so it was probably fairly well known back in the day.
And yet the author is not that well known today, is he?
No.
I can't remember when he was born, but I know that he died about 2 years after this book was published. And in fact, he took his own life. Apparently, he was in very dire economic circumstances and possibly had been going through a bad divorce as well. And he took his own life.
In fact, that's why we have this book available as an ebook from Gutenberg and other sources. Mm-hmm. He put all of his works into the public domain, kind of despite his inheritors, I think is probably the right word, which might include his wife at the time.
Yeah. As far as I know, almost his entire body of work is in the public domain, whereas his contemporaries, who would have been people like Heinlein and Asimov, much of their work is still in copyright because the copyrights were renewed at the appropriate times.
His birth date was 1904.
Okay, actually, so that makes him a little bit older than the other authors I just mentioned.
Yeah, he would have been about 60 when he took his life. And he was a little eccentric, as I think science fiction authors and maybe science fiction readers and podcasters tend to be.
What are you saying?
I wear that title pretty accurately. And Little Fuzzy, like I said, was pretty popular. It was nominated for a Hugo. There was a sequel that came out in 1964. And then, he tragically took his own life. He assigned all of his works to John Carr, the science fiction author. And John has managed those assets, I'd say, pretty well. Many of the series that Piper was known for, he has carried on either licensing works to other authors or continuing to develop himself.
Wow. Many writers have had a go at either writing a sequel to the Fuzzy stories or sort of rebooting them as Scalzi has done.
Ace Books hired people to do some related works.
Ah, okay.
And in 1984, they actually found a lost Piper manuscript.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was published as Fuzzies and Other People. And then there were a handful of other sequels.
Do you feel up to summarizing the plot of Little Fuzzy?
Yes. So we're introduced to Jack Holloway, twirling his mustache, smoking his pipe, and having a drink. And he is a prospector, a science fiction prospector on another planet where they are, and I should have written that down. They are looking for these magical little thermally active gemstones that heat or that emit light. Yeah. In the presence of heat. And so they're very popular as human jewelry. And Jack is, blowing up things and doing explorations to try and find them because they're extremely profitable. And he goes home one day to find out that he's no longer alone in his little house. There's something in there. It's a little fuzzy thing. It's about the size of a cat, but it walks on hind feet. And as Jack begins to learn about this thing, which he initially considers an animal, he begins to think it's highly intelligent, and it has a family, and it's a tool user. There are these little animals, other animals called land crabs, and Little Fuzzy, as he eventually calls this this creature, will take his stick and flip the animal over, stab it in the center of its chest to kill it, and then peel back all the shell to eat what's inside. Mm-hmm. And he realizes this is a very important thing, because the Big Bad Corporation will lose its license to be on the planet if there is an intelligent sentient species. So he brings in some friends to document what's going on, and he notifies the corporation. The corporation loses their mind, and in the process of them trying to learn about the animals, they kill one of Little Fuzzy's, I'm going to say tribe for lack of a better word, maybe family.
Yeah.
And Jack shoots the guy that kills the little baby Fuzzy in revenge, or in Frontier Justice, because killing a sentient is illegal in the galaxy.
Yeah.
And then there's a very protracted legal discussion about who can do what and how you can do it. And we learn that the Fuzzies are intelligent. They just speak in a range of frequencies so high above us that we can't hear them.
Yeah, which is a nice science fictional element, I suppose.
Yeah, it reminds me of thinking about dolphins being intelligent, or whales. Yeah. Of course, they speak in the other frequency range, or elephants even.
Yes.
And because we don't either can't hear it or don't understand it, we have a hard time understanding or recognizing their intelligence and sentience.
Yeah. There is one thing the Fuzzies do or say that we can hear, and that is yeek.
Yeek.
They say that all the way through the world. Yeek.
Yeek.
Yeah. I've got here the description of Little Fuzzy when he first appears. This is what H. Beam Piper writes. He says, "He turned quickly to see two wide eyes staring up at him out of a ball of golden fur. Whatever it was, it had a round head and big ears, and a vaguely humanoid face with a little snub nose. It was sitting on its haunches, and in that position it was about a foot high." That's the creature that we're talking about, and they're called Fuzzies because they are fuzzy. Something that surprised me about Little Fuzzy is that it very specifically and explicitly talks about ecology. And I didn't expect to see that in a book from 1962. Because to me, any knowledge of ecology is more sort of a 1970s thing. So it felt as if it was ahead of its time. Whether it really was or not, I don't know. I may just be ignorant of that. But at the same time, it felt as if the story wasn't really on an alien planet. It felt as if this was a story in Africa.
Yeah.
The sunstones or whatever it is that they're mining are diamonds. There's seem to be a lot of background characters who have sort of Dutch sounding names or Afrikaans sounding names, and it really felt to me as if this was a writer who's really modeling the world on Africa and was sort of science fictionifying it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I can see that.
But that doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but I think it does make it feel a little bit dated, because it feels a bit like it's from a colonial era and not so much from our modern world. But at the same time, it's got this concern for ecology, which does make it feel a bit more modern than it is. So it's a really strange mixture. I also felt it was a very patchy book. It seemed to raise issues multiple times without necessarily dealing with them. So it would talk about sentience, but not go anywhere with it, and then bring it up again at a later point, but not deal with it, and then ultimately make it the centre of the court case at the end, where we need a kind of a legal ruling on whether these creatures are sentient, or sapient, I think is the word he uses.
Yes.
So it felt like a first draft. Nevertheless, it was better than I expected it to be.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I think I did.
Yeah, socially, I don't know, socially, because the way everyone interacts is you go to somebody's house and watch their Fuzzies, and you smoke and pull out a pipe, and there's lots of drinks that are created, and that culture, I think, still does exist today to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, reminded me of watching old Perry Mason episodes in a way.
Yeah.
Everybody smokes and everybody drinks. And
there's a little scene fairly early on where we're first really getting to know Little Fuzzy and what he can do. And we see that he's learning, and he is, in the words of the book, he is generalizing. So, for example, Little Fuzzy learns how bottle tops work, screw caps on bottles.
Oh.
He figures out that if you turn it, sometimes it will come off and sometimes it won't. And he figures out that, no, to take it off, you've always got to turn it the same way. And to put it back on, you've always got to turn it the opposite way. So we see a process of learning. He does the same with a nut and a bolt. I can't remember quite how he comes to have a nut and a bolt, but he does the same thing. He sort of figures out how those work. So mm-hmm. I thought this was nicely done in a visual sense, and I could see that in a movie. And I think, don't we find that the Fuzzies have their own tools for breaking open the land crabs?
Mm-hmm.
But don't they personalize them or something, or modify them?
They're created by hand. They're not just picking up a stone and using it as
right.
a scraper. They're shaped.
Yeah.
And Jack gives them metal versions of their tools, which then they actually trade to other Fuzzy people.
Right.
There is some joining of a tribe, like they find some other wild Fuzzies, and it turns out that the Fuzzies that are, you know, Jack's friends need more mates. And so they're about to go to war, and then they make peace, and then they join together, and then Jack's tribe continues to grow. I wish I'd written down the names for all the different Fuzzies.
Some other interesting things, as we begin to learn about these creatures, we begin to learn about how people determine whether an alien species is considered sort of worthy of being thought of as sentient or sapient.
Yes.
And a sort of a rule of thumb that is mentioned a couple of times is the talk and build a fire rule. So, you know, if you come across an alien species and you find that they talk and they build fires, then they are probably sentient or sapient. One of the characters also says, anything that talks and builds a fire is a sapient being. Yes, that's the law. But that doesn't mean that anything that doesn't do those things isn't.
Well, and because we can't hear these Fuzzies talk and they don't build fires, they're still,
right.
you know, I would say Neolithic almost.
Yeah.
Except they have wooden tools, so that's probably not the right phrase for it. But
yeah, yeah. And then, of course, as you say, later on, we learn that they do talk, but they just do it outside of our hearing range. Our frequency range. What I found interesting is that although this planet is sort of operated by a company, a corporation, there is also a federation. And it did feel very much like Star Trek. It made me wonder whether Gene Roddenberry had ever read H. Beam Piper.
Yeah, I wonder how much of a common thread that was. This idea that, you know, like the United Nations, that you could have independent countries or colonies or planets that needed some overarching system of organization and regulation and rule enforcement and support, protection.
Yeah. So you're thinking this might well have been a common thing in science fiction of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much to learn, so much to not know.
Well, we'd have to read everything, wouldn't we, to try and figure out where his influences were.
Yeah. I was struck by several quotes through the book, because some things are so different from the way times, you know, our culture is today in 2023.
Yeah.
Other things are very familiar. There's a quote right from the beginning of the book from the psychologist. It says, if you don't like the facts, you ignore them. And if you need facts, dream up some you do like. Yeah, that seems very familiar in the United States these days.
Not just the United States, I can assure you. A bit later on in the book, there is talk about... We can talk about the difference between an intelligent alien and an alien that is more at the level of a cat or a dog or something like that. But mm-hmm. there's a very sharp observation that comes out in a piece of conversation where somebody talks about collecting fuzzy pelts. You know, so not even farming these animals or using them as pets, but literally hunting them down and taking their skins, you know, which is what humans have done for thousands of years. But then somebody says, that would be genocide if you killed all those fuzzies for their pelts.
Yeah.
And the character replies, nonsense. Genocide is defined as being the extermination of a race of sapient beings. These are fur-bearing animals. Yeah, that puts a very clear demarcation line between what people consider exploitable and what they consider not exploitable.
It was at least conceivable. And, you know, who knows if it's actually happened or not. That would be pretty scary.
Yeah.
Although it does define the evil corporation pretty well.
Yes, it does. And I have to say that's my least favourite aspect of the book, because I think it's a bit of an irrelevance. The fact that the author happens to have written this story in this corporation colony. I think the issues to do with intelligence and how you treat other species are far bigger than that. And I think to make it largely about an evil corporation is minimising the moral and ethical debate to a large degree. And I think that carries over into Scalzi's book, because I think he emphasises all of that as well. So I don't find that so interesting.
I wonder if you could re-envision this a third way, where there is no corporation, but in the process of learning about these animals being intelligent or not, somebody kills one.
Mm.
And so then there would be a trial to determine, did this person commit murder, or was he just, you know, did he just kill an animal for some reason?
Yeah. I think I would prefer that. I'd prefer it to be more pure in that sense. But it's okay of its type, you know. But I think that's part of what makes the book feel dated. I think all of the corporation stuff feels dated. Even though Scalzi updates it, it still feels like a very old-fashioned kind of storytelling.
Yeah, evil corporation does evil.
Yeah. There's also discussion about whether language is that important. Yeah, somebody makes mention of Helen Keller, who's famously the deaf-blind woman who... I think she became a writer, didn't she?
I think so. Well, I mean, she was famous just for the fact that since she could not hear or speak, that she could communicate.
That's right, yes. And her... I can't remember the name of her facilitator, but she had an assistant who helped her learn to communicate with the outside world through sort of fingerspelling and touch rather than through vocalization and so on. So she's brought up simply as an example of somebody who was clearly intelligent but didn't have the power of speech. So that comes into the discussion of, well, these fuzzies can't be sapient because they don't talk. Of course, it turns out they can talk, so that's all moot anyway. But these are interesting little philosophical nuggets that are being thrown into the discussion, and I like all this stuff.
Yeah, that's one thing I like about science fiction, is it makes you think.
Yeah.
How do we define people, and how do we define intelligence, and how are our laws and morals applied in some situations and not others? And is that really the right thing to do or not?
Yeah. And historically, of course, what we've done as a species is we've tended to say, these are the boundaries of intelligence. Unless you can speak and unless you can use tools, you're not intelligent. You're just an animal. And then we find animals that do use tools, and we find animals that do use rudimentary language. So these are intelligent, yes? And of course, when we get to that, no. They have to do these other things as well. We've come up with these five other criteria. And it seems like we're always inventing new criteria, new hurdles for a hypothetical intelligent species to have to leap over. And I love this kind of discussion in science fiction. Equally, there are some things which are just bizarre. So there's one little scene I've got on my Kindle right here. While they watched, Little Fuzzy snapped the lighter and held the flame to the pipe bowl, puffing. So he learns how to smoke a pipe, for goodness sake.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
Sometimes science fiction is just written in our language, and in other times, words get invented and thrown into the lingo. And one of the things I enjoy is how well they're integrated. So one of the other recognized sapient species are the Kugra.
And
they're not very smart, and they're not very likable, that are defined that way. And so into the vernacular is, you know, you can be a dumb son of a Kugra.
Something which I found disappointing on behalf of our species. I think I may be wrong in this, but I think by the end of the book, it's kind of decided that, yeah, these fuzzies are sapient. Mm-hmm. But somebody says, you must think the fuzzies are going to need a lot of protection. They will, says the other character. And they talk about, well, there will be a fuzzy reservation and it'll have to be policed. And then the fuzzies outside the reservation will also have to be protected. And he says, you know, it's going to happen. Everybody wants fuzzies. Why, even the judge approached me about getting a pair for his wife. So even though this species has been judged to be sapient, the best that we can do for them is to create a reservation and keep them as pets. And I don't think this is being said ironically. I think this is just being presented as, oh, this is the inevitable next thing that's going to happen. I was a bit shocked by that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because I was thinking they were going to get the planet to themselves, you know, that all the humans would leave and the fuzzies would have the right of self-determination.
Yeah, well, that's the prime directive in you speaking.
Yeah.
I see some parallels here with slavery.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
We found these intelligent creatures, but they're not quite as smart of us, so we're going to take them on as house staff and field workers and pets instead of recognizing them as independent people with rights and desires.
Yeah. I wonder if doing it any other way would have felt a bit too advanced in 1962. I'd love to know whether it felt like an uneven book back in the day, or whether readers in 1962 thought this was a beautifully laid out philosophical discussion of an issue.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's a huge advantage we have these days. We could go search Reddit and see what people's opinion are on books, or Goodreads, and get, you know, public and professional critics as well, and see what their take is on books in various ways.
Yes.
To do this in 1962, we would have to hope that somebody wrote a letter to an editor, or there was a column in a magazine, and go to it, or see if there were, you know, fanzines that wrote about this that might be around, and who knows? I'm looking up right now real quick in ISFDB, which tends to cover publication history for works, to see if they have that. Okay, there is a 1962 review of Little Fuzzy by P. Schuyler Miller. It doesn't say where. So yeah, I mean, I should have done a little more research on this.
Well, perhaps we could have a look and then come back to this in a later episode.
Yeah. Well, John Scalzi liked it so much that he did reboot it, as we've learned.
Yeah. Do you know what his motivation was?
Yeah, I read a little bit about that. He has an excellent interview in Clark's World where he talks about this on the 10th anniversary of the publication of Fuzzy Nation. And I'll make sure you get that link so we can drop it in the podcast notes. But the short story is this. He was in a contract dispute with Tor Books, and was kind of at liberty to do what he wanted. And he wanted to do a fun project. And he had liked the novel, and it was in the public domain. And so he, in his free time, kind of like what Brandon Sanderson did during the pandemic with his four secret novels, wrote this reboot modernization of the Fuzzy story called Fuzzy Nation. And it is... It's very John Scalzi like because of the technology and the snark and the writing. Although uniquely, this is the first time he wrote a protagonist that is, I'm going to be blunt, he's an asshole. The Jack Holloway from the original book, we like Jack.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Right. I kind of like the new Jack Holloway. But the things he does, and it's like, yeah, that was wrong. You probably shouldn't have done that. And then he ends up paying for it in the plot in various ways. And he's a jerk. He's dishonest. He's selfish.
Yeah. As I was reading it, at first, I wasn't enjoying that characterization, and I didn't think that the book knew what it was doing to that character. But as you say, at the end, there is a... the character actually comes out and acknowledges what he is. So, the author and the book clearly know what they're doing with the character there. But, mm-hmm. He's not as likable as the original character, the Piper version.
Yeah, I mean, he does have a dog, and that's always a good redeeming quality in humans, for most humans.
Yeah, yeah.
And the dog, Carl, ends up being... he's a scene stealer, just in adorable and interesting ways.
Yeah.
If you pay attention to the plot closely enough, you can learn through the little fuzzy's interactions with Carl that they're actually intelligent. Because they learn that Carl is an animal, but he has certain rights that they don't. Like, he can come in and out of the house because there's an electronically keyed flap.
Yeah.
And they train him to open the door for them.
Yes, that's right. So that is the first difference that sort of hits you in the face. I immediately felt that, aha, this is now going to be commenting on the previous version of the story, because now we've no longer got humans and fuzzies and nothing in between. We've now got this sort of continuum that's built up. We've got humans, we've got intelligent animals, which are not sapient, i.e. dogs. Mm-hmm. And then we've got this other species, and we're going to try and fit them in somewhere in between the two extremes of human and dog, if you like. So I thought that was a wise move. And I also felt, if ever anyone makes a movie of this, they're going to keep the dog, most definitely, because it's one of the best parts of the story.
Oh, yes.
What do you see as the big differences between the original novel and Scalzi's remake?
The highlights of the plot are all there.
Yeah.
How do I describe this? It would be like having the same skeleton, but different musculature and hair color and eyeballs, so that while fundamentally at the very core it is the same. It's a highly canonical adaptation. Mm-hmm. But with the main character not being the old Pappy Jack with his pipe and his whiskey, this is fallen lawyer Jack Holloway, who lied and lost his girlfriend because he lied about her, and uses dogs to blow up mountains, and is manipulative, and yet recognizes the sapience of these creatures and does not fall prey to the temptation to just hide it. So there is some moral founding to him. And the other characters are much more in the forefront in this story than the other story.
And they sort of have relationships to each other. Whereas I felt in the Piper version, they're just characters who come on because they have one plot function and one function only. All of that is an improvement over the original novel. But I don't know in my heart of hearts whether it does make the reboot any better than the original in any significant or substantial way. I think the business with the dog does improve things. The rest of it just seems like variations on a theme, but for no particular reason.
No, I think you're right. I think the discussion of the ecology of the planet that is being ruined by Evil Corporation, that's not present in the new book.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there are, there's not the struggling of defining sapience quite as much in the newer story versus the older story.
Yeah.
I personally like it better, but I think that's because I'm so familiar with Scalzi's works, and I really enjoy his style of writing and what he brings out.
Yeah.
In fact, at one point, I was hoping that Jack and Ruth, the Xeno psychologist, would be reunited because of what Jack's, his heroism and the good things that he does. And it turns out that that's broken and can never, ever be repaired. And
Does it feel as if this book is connected to any of Scalzi's other books?
Okay, let me freestyle for a little bit and then maybe draw something from it. Yeah. So the thing I'm getting is, pets are a central part of John Scalzi's life, and so is family.
Okay.
And so seeing those connections in this book makes me realize, yes, this is Scalzi. Although if you look at his other books, that's not something so much in the fore. Okay. So I recognize it from his writing, because he writes and blogs a lot. A character with snark, who's extremely intelligent, who's trying to put one over on someone else, that is quintessential John Scalzi. So if you like that kind of a thing, you like his other books.
Right. Yeah.
His books tend to be, I think, very smart. Like, you're not gonna find something and say, well, this is a nitpick that I don't think is quite right about this, because his writing is very polished. I think it's very well thought out. Now, that could be the fanboy in me talking too.
Yeah. But it's often the kind of thing that draws you to read another book by the same author. You know, you get a feeling for the tone that is characteristic of their authorship. Incidentally, I listened to the audiobook of this, which is narrated by Will Wheaton. He is perfect for this, because he does snark really well. I mean, he's most famous for sort of playing rather innocent characters, both in Star Trek and before Star Trek. But, you know, if you've seen him doing any comedy, you know that he's also quite good at that. And he really does get the snark tone for this. It's very well worth listening to.
Yeah, and he does read a lot of John's works.
Oh, does he?
He does. Yeah. I wouldn't say he has some favorite. Maybe he does have some favorite audiobook narrators. Zachary Quinto does an excellent job of doing his Audible production book called The Dispatcher. And I think Amber Beeson has done several books.
I wrote down most of the expansion/updating/new material in Fuzzy Nation is about the corrupt corporation, which leaves me totally cold. So it felt to me, I mean, this is a ridiculous comparison, really, but do you remember sort of primetime soap operas in the 80s, Dallas and Dynasty and Falcon Crest and all of those? They were always about corporations and usually members of families screwing each other over in the name of business. And that's what this reminded me of. I'm reading it and I'm thinking, I don't really care about any of this.
Yeah, if there's a modernization to it, I think they actually back off on the evil corporation biz a little bit and bring out the evil CEO.
Right, yeah.
Because when the new prospective CEO, the new heir, oversteps his boundaries, in the very end, his handler steps in and, you know, starts to fix things.
Yes.
So, yeah, once the final adjudication goes against him, it's like, yeah, you won't have to worry about him anymore. He's not going to be causing anybody else problems. And
and the courtroom drama in this version, in Scalzi's version, obviously it takes up a large part of the book, as it does in H.B. and Piper's book. But the Piper ones seem to be much more focused on the question of sentience or sapience. And in the Scalzi telling of the story, it seems to be much more about kind of playing dirty tricks on the other side. So, for example, Holloway accuses one of the characters, I forget the name of the character, but he accuses him of murder because he killed a Fuzzy. But he makes that accusation. I mean, he hints at the accusation earlier on in the book, but he formally makes that accusation in court just after the judge has basically said that Fuzzies are sentient. But the killing took place before that judgment was made. So you can't establish a legal precedent and then apply it retroactively. You can only say from this day forward it will be murder if anyone kills a Fuzzy. But Holloway makes that accusation straight away, you know, and it's sort of presented in this melodramatic way as, oh, he's got him now. But no, not really. And the contrary position, the position that I've just put, doesn't come into the discussion. So I felt that the courtroom stuff was all a bit melodramatic. And some of it, frankly, was nonsensical, with the judge making things up as they went along. So I wasn't really very convinced by the courtroom stuff at all.
It does seem more like a frontier law.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
You know, it's not well established. It has to be developed. And Although the part about establishing sentience and retroactiveness is they suspected that the fuzzies were intelligent and were trying to cover it up.
True.
And so given that aspect, I wonder if it would apply retroactively.
Yeah, yeah.
But because that think also happens in the first book.
I suppose it does, yes. Yeah.
Right. So the evil henchman stomps a fuzzy and kills it. Jack shoots the evil henchman. The corporation demands that Jack be arrested because he's murdered a human. And Jack mm-hmm. counters saying, well, you killed a sentient.
Yes.
And so they have to establish the sentience before they know if it's murder and then go from there.
Yeah. And the logic of that seems a bit more persuasive to me. I mean, whether legally that would pan out, I don't know. But in terms of storytelling logic, that seemed plausible. But I felt the way Scalzi was doing it didn't feel quite as plausible. There's one little element which I think is present in Piper's book, but I don't think is in Scalzi's. Or if it is, it's sort of glanced over. Mm-hmm. And that is in the Piper book, the fuzzies, we learn, bury their dead. And that is sort of used as a little moment for reflection on, well, that probably means they're sentient then, because we do that. You know, again, this is one of these things, we do a thing, therefore that's got to be a criterion for considering somebody to be as worthy as we are.
Yes. There's a particular quote from the book that I really like that I'd like to read.
Hmm.
Just to give people a feel for his writing and kind of what we're talking about with Snark.
Yeah.
Carl was frustrated, but he was also well-trained. Any dog that could wait for an order to detonate explosives was one that knew how to listen to its master.
And of course, Carl has been trained to actually blow things up on Jack's behalf, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. And the way I think it worked was Jack took Carl when he would detonate these explosives to try and find the Sunstones. And Carl is trained to recognize the word boom. Boom is a bad thing. And so to help Carl adjust and become used to boom, he teaches Carl to press the button to make the boom happen and then get a reward afterwards through classic desensitization techniques.
Very good. Good dog. Good dog.
Yes.
There's just one thing that I highlighted in the Kindle version of Fuzzy Nation. And that is the it's something I don't normally even read, but on the sort of the page, the copyright page, where they have the library classification information, it has three categories for this book to be sort of filed under. And one is Life on Other Planets, fiction. The second one is Space Colonies, fiction. And the third one is Corporations, Corrupt Practices, fiction. So that really states it quite clearly what the three main threads of this book are.
Yes.
If you could only read one fuzzy book, which one would you choose?
Oh.
I know it's a silly question because you've read both, but...
Yeah, and I read the Scalzi one first and then learned where it came from, and I went back and read the original. And for me, that's odd, because when, in my other podcast, I am well known for always reading the book first and watching the movie second.
Right.
There's a couple of times we've reversed that to see if that causes a bias in me, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that's the way I do things. I go to the original, and then I go to the sequel.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that in this case. And because, you know, my initial response would be, well, I think I would take the Scalzi book.
Mm.
But, you know, there are elements of the first book that I would miss because they aren't here in this book.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to have an interesting order in which to have read them. So I did the opposite. I did read the early book, the original book first, followed by the reboot. But even so, I think I would recommend that people read the Scalzi version, simply because I think it is an easier read, because it's sort of extrapolated from our world, and therefore it's sort of a bit easier to understand. I mean, not that Little Fuzzy is difficult to understand, but it's quite clearly a weird mixture of the futuristic and the clunky because it's from this earlier time. I mean, for example, there's in the court case, they have a kind of a lie detector, don't they? I can't remember what it's called, but in the Piper book, it's a truth divining machine that everybody who's testifying has to suffer. But that's not in the Scalzi. He doesn't bother with that. He just goes for melodramatic argument, legal argument. And there's some other things as well. Actually, it's these minor things that have stuck in my mind that in the Piper book, they call each other up over Zoom because they're not just on the phone. They're using sort of video phones. I can't remember what he calls them. And that felt very Star Trek again, because that's what they do in Star Trek. You know, they press a button and they talk to the Vulcan ambassador over Zoom, essentially. But so that's the modern bit. That felt modern. But the very non-modern bit is that when you put in a call to somebody over Zoom, you talk to their secretary first, and they then put you through.
Oh.
So it that felt really 1962, you know, like going through a switchboard operator. But then again, that is very Star Trek. That's what Uhura's job is. You know, she's,
okay, let me ask you a question. If you needed to talk to the president of the University of Wolverhampton, would you dial him up directly on Zoom, or would you arrange something through his office?
There is a direct number. But he wouldn't answer. You see, it would be a secretary. It would be a PA who would answer. So yeah, you're quite right. That is the same as our world, but it just seemed to happen every time anybody made a phone call in this book. Whereas in real life, it's not like that. You know, a lot of people you can call up, and you don't have to go through a secretary.
Yeah.
But yeah, I take your point.
Yeah, because you and I don't have secretaries.
No.
I think one time I jokingly referred to my wife in that fashion, and she very quickly disabused me of that fact, and I have learned since then.
Yeah, overall then, I think I slightly prefer Piper's take on the story, because I think he's focused a little bit more on the philosophical argument. But the overall feeling is that it's quite a dated telling of the story. So Scalzi's makes a bit more sense. And it's probably more even in tone as well. I think Piper's book is a bit uneven in tone and is a bit repetitive in places, and it doesn't feel properly structured. It feels like it's being made up as it goes along. Scalzi's feels a bit more structured because obviously he's had the benefit of reading a first draft, which happens to have been written by somebody else, in a sense.
Yeah.
But can you think of any other book that does this? That essentially is, I mean, we're talking about adaptation, and all the time we see films that are based on a book. We very rarely see books that are based on a book. We see sequels, but
yes,
we very rarely see somebody doing a rewrite.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of sequels off the top of my head, like The Night of the Triffids, which is the sequel to The Day of the Triffids, but was written decades later.
Yes.
And I'll be mentioning this later, but there is a sequel to Who Goes There by Campbell.
Yeah.
But again, that's a sequel, not a reimagining or a modernization or something else. You know, sometimes people will say in their works, you know, I was strongly influenced by this book, and so you can see the influences in there, but it's not where you take character names and the skeleton of the plot and build a new thing around it. I don't think I've ever come across that, which just means I may not be widely enough read.
Yeah, same goes for me as well. I mean, I can't really think. I can think of parodies, and I can think of sequels, and I can think of people kind of expanding on a universe that somebody else has created. But I can't think of anybody basically rewriting a book that somebody else wrote. We don't have a quiz this week, folks. I hope you're not disappointed. I know I know some people enjoy the quizzes, but we'll have one next time, I'm sure. But that means we can move straight on to our usual discussion of past, present and future. So I'd like to lead off with the past item. Having read H. Beam Piper, I was prompted to look at his body of work and see if there was anything else that I wanted to read, and I came across a short story called Omnilingual, which I've seen in a couple of anthologies over the years. I don't particularly remember it, but I read it on Gutenberg, Project Gutenberg, because it's another one of these out of copyright stories. And it's quite good. Again, a little bit dated in some respects, but it's a story about scientists finding archaeological remnants of an extinct Martian civilization, and they try to decipher some kind of document, and they succeed in doing it. And I saw, when I was reading around it, that some writers and critics have really referred to the story as being a kind of a quintessential science fiction story, even allowing for the sort of the trick that the story depends upon. So read some more H. Beam Piper. If you don't have time for Little Fuzzy, just read what is probably his best short story, Omnilingual. Do you have any past items, Colin?
I do. There was a recent article on Tor's website about the Cordwainer Smith Rediscovery Award. Mm-hmm. This was started in 2001, and it's for what the jury thinks are unjustly forgotten science fiction authors.
Okay.
And so if you're interested in reading past science fiction, you should look up the Cordwainer Smith Rediscovery Award and find who these people are and see if their works are available and read them.
Very good. Are these announced annually?
Yes. Yeah, been running since 2001. The inaugural winner was somebody called Olaf Stapledon.
Oh, yes. I've read some of him. Yeah.
Okay.
He's British, you know.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yes.
Henry Kuttner.
Okay, yeah.
Lee Brackett. Many authors, you know, some of which I think we've actually covered.
Yeah, indeed. So let's do present then. I've got two present items. The first one is, I don't like to plug other people's podcasts, but I came across a podcast called Dead Planet Society the other day. It's a new podcast from the New Scientist magazine. And they basically ask hypothetical questions and then try and figure out the answers to them. And in the first episode, they take this ridiculous question of, supposing we wanted to put out the fire of the sun, could we do it by having a huge ball of water the same size as the sun? So they talk through the logic of, well, what would happen if you try to make a ball of water that big? And because, you know, my first instinct is to say, well, the gravitation would cause it to sort of collapse in on itself and maybe it would turn solid. So it would be an ice planet. But they talk through what would really happen. I mean, some of this is pure speculation, but some of it is well explained scientifically. So they just take these sort of odd science fictional ideas and then look at the consequences of them. So that's Dead Planets Society. Planets with an S on the end. Ah,
and you really like that?
Yeah, I've only heard the first episode, but yeah, it was good fun.
Do you know the webcomic XKCD?
I know of it, yes. I have seen some of it, yeah.
Yeah. So Randall Monroe had a blog series called What If?
Yes.
And then he published a book from there, which is literally chock full of questions like that.
So now you mention it, yes, this is a bit of a ripoff.
No, it's just, you know, there's only so many questions that people have time to explore. Yeah, like, you know, not everyone's going to ask the question, what happens if you throw a baseball at the speed of light?
Yeah.
Or can you put out the sun with a sun-sized ball of water? Or
And I have to say, I still don't know. I listened to the whole podcast and they went through so many alternatives. I couldn't tell you whether you could put the sun out with a ball of water. I don't think you can, but I can't remember now. My other present item is, speaking of Tor.com, which has been mentioned a couple of times in today's show, a few days ago they put out a 15th anniversary short fiction bundle. Basically an ebook with some of the best short fiction that they've been publishing in the past 15 years. So, I mean, they've always put stuff up for free, as well as the stuff that they published for sale. but this is quite a nice collection of modern-ish science fiction. So well worth a look. We'll have a link on our blog for that. What present items have you got?
I have a couple, and they're pretty unusual. Fuzzy Nation could almost be considered fan fiction. In fact, when John Scalzi was interviewed about it, he said, yeah, I wrote fan fiction about a little Fuzzy. Yeah. And Andy Weir, on his Twitter page, recently endorsed a piece of fan fiction from the Artemis universe, his second book.
Okay.
It's called Artemis, the Fra Mauro Job. And so it's set on the moon. And in that universe, with that, you know, the base there, Artemis base, and it was a good read. I'll make sure we have a link to it so people can read it.
Very good.
And the other thing is, I mentioned this in brief, John Betancourt came and found the original version of the shorter story, Who Goes There, which was called Frozen Hell, and then ran a Kickstarter for the publication of it in hardback and EPUB form.
Right, yeah.
And he has now written a sequel to that.
Okay.
Called The Things from Another World, which talks about the things themselves and the further threat to humanity from finding more of them and what it means about our place in the universe.
Okay. And then for the future, I shall do a shameless plug here. In a few days' time, well, in about 6 days from now, as I speak, we have the official premiere of The Crystal Egg. I'm in an online drama group, and we basically meet over Zoom and we perform. And what we've been rehearsing for weeks, it seems, is an adaptation of an H.G. Wells story called Crystal Egg, which is a kind of precursor to War of the Worlds. He actually wrote it the same year that he wrote War of the Worlds. And basically, we perform it as a verbal performance. During the rehearsals, we started adding in illustrations to kind of relieve the tedium for the viewer of having to watch us in a Zoom meeting reading from scripts. And the further we went on, the more we felt that we didn't want to be seen on screen, and it became an illustrated performance. And I did all the illustrations using AI. I had to tame some AI to make it provide images for me. And so we have the premiere of this on the 30th of July on YouTube. And after the premiere, it will stay on YouTube so people can go and have a look. We're only amateurs, so don't judge us too harshly, but it might be worth a look.
I've mentioned this to people that I thought would be interested in it. And one question that has come up a few times is, are you going to do a live broadcast of this, or will this be a recording that is in like a YouTube premiere on the release date and then be available?
That's exactly what it is. It's a YouTube premiere. Yeah. So we talked about doing it live, but there are various reasons for not doing that. One of which is the time zone problem. Because I'm in the UK, some of the other people involved in the group are on the west coast of the US, some are on the east coast, some are in the middle. And actually finding a decent time for a live performance was difficult.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it reminds me of the full cast recordings from Alien Voices.
Yeah, I don't think we're in that league. I mean, we kind of have ambitions to be in that league, but obviously we're not Leonard Nimoy or... John DeLancey, yeah. So we're not in that league as performers. But, yeah, it's that kind of thing. And we've got a few sound effects in there as well.
The next 3 to 4 months are really exciting for me because a lot of the things that I like, I have new releases coming out. The release of the series Ahsoka is at the midpoint or end of August. John Scalzi's new work, Starter Villain, is coming out. There's going to be a new Murderbot book. Okay. And I want to say there's another release of a book in Mary Robinette Cole's Lady Astronaut universe.
Okay, yeah.
So a lot of good reading in my future. Mm. Yeah, but that's all for me.
I think that's all from me as well. So thanks for listening, everyone. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme music is from purpleplanet.com. Check out the show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com where you can also leave us a comment, or, well, you could even drop a couple of quid in the old tip jar. And don't forget to give us a nice 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time.